You're listening to Innovation for Alpha, where we explore everything at the intersection of healthcare innovation and finance. Through our discussions and interviews, we keep you informed and educated about healthcare innovations, next-level venture investing, and everything involving the combination of the two.
Hi, everybody. This is Tobin Arthur, your host for Innovation for Alpha. And today I'm joined by Chris Furman, who is the CEO of Vitro Biopharma, a really interesting company based here in Colorado. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tobin. Appreciate the time.
This is going to be fun. I've gotten to know Chris, and he's got a terrific background, which is an unusual background a little bit for a pharma company. Chris comes from a finance background, and I want to get into that, Chris, and just have you lay out your background and how you got, first of all, introduced to Vitro, and then what excited you about the company. So why don't we start with your history a little bit?
Yeah, thanks, Tobin. I appreciate it. So, you know, by roots, I'm a finance person. I spent about 24 years at Janus Capital, building out various business lines and product distribution, et cetera, and then decided at the ripe age of 42 years old that I wanted to expand my career and expand outside of the typical world within asset management, and went to work with Aramark Partners and became, I always like to joke, I got a PhD in bank debt, CLOs, et cetera. And from that point, taking another step in this journey that I went down, started a firm called Form Capital Advisors, a real estate private debt fund that we ran successfully for 3 years. And I got to that inflection point. My wife came to me and said, look, three boys under the age of 21, 80 hours a week doesn't cut it. So I spent a year consulting. And during that time, had a massive orthopedic injury and started to look at stem cells, et cetera, across the board. And you read about Peyton Manning, for example, going to Germany and all the controversy there that he couldn't grip a football. But what I found was there were massive potential within cell-based therapy. And I don't even say stem cells anymore, because the capabilities there are very broad. And there's a lot of misinformation there within what cell therapy can do. And so I looked at Vitro Biopharma. What led me to that research was a lot of doctors outside the United States using their product called Allerex for orthopedic treatment. And that led me further down a path to realize that the potential for cell therapy was really a broad green pasture. And so I'd gotten to know Vitro, had worked with the board, et cetera. And it was a classic startup, you know, whether it's tech or biotech, the founder and everybody tries to run the company. At some point, you get to an issue, an inflection point, if you will, where you need to bring in people to actually run the business. And given my depth of running businesses and taking over tough situations, when I was at Janus Capital starting my own firm, I had the skill set that matched up very well for what Vitro's needs were. And so I began, as they extended the offer in July of 22, to come in and organize the company into a salient business model, if you will, to execute on all of Jim Musick's research over the last 22 years.
As you mentioned, it is, you know, a lot of the classic startup elements to it, but it's a company that's been around for a while. And so there's a lot of depth. There's a lot of value that's been built, a lot of really interesting opportunities for this company, which, of course, lends to some of the complexity, how to navigate that and focus in on that. But maybe just start with a little bit of a highlight of the technology. Where did it start? And give us a, you know, a glimpse of some of the things that have been developed over time.
Yeah. And so that, you know, you unpack a lot there, because I joke that Vitro is really a 22-year-old startup. Jim Musick, who got his PhD at University of Northwestern, as we all know it, started the company really doing diagnostic cell lines and selling those cell lines to various big pharma. So Takeda, Glaxo, Pfizer, et cetera. And he'd always had this thesis regarding cell therapy, that once we had the capability to derive very potent cells and then deliver enough of those cells either intravenously or directly into the body, that cell therapy would be a very good complement to big pharma, but also independently. So that's what makes Vitro a little bit unique. So what happened was he developed our patents and our trade secrets to derive the cells. He eliminated all the ethical concerns, because our cells are derived from the most potent mesenchymal stem cells, which is out of the umbilical cord. But the beauty is you eliminate all the ethical concerns, because they are derived from postpartum, full-term, healthy baby deliveries. And then the umbilical cord is sent and genetically tested, et cetera. Where our secret sauce, if you will, starts is in the derivation of those cells and then the growth of those cells. So we've addressed where cell therapy has not worked in the past, in that the potency, number one, can the cells get there and do their job? Or if you want to get into the science of it, the mitochondrial activity. And then secondarily, you have to deliver enough of the cells to actually be an actual therapy. So Jim derived that, and all of our trade secrets are around step one, from the extraction of the cells through to the expansion of the cells to derive enough of the cells to deliver to the body. And so what has happened is the immediate thing that all biotechs do, you go to the FDA, you file for an IND, of which we currently have two that are effective, ready for human trials. The third will be completed by June. For existing revenue outside the US, countries have approved the use of our cells. And so doctors go through a rigorous due diligence process to use them at their clinics to deliver the cells. So we currently have a revenue stream of the old business line of selling our cells to Big Pharma. And then we also have doctors outside the United States that can use our cells. But our focus really is in the production of what we call Allerex, which is our primary therapeutic that we're using for FDA approval right now.
Let's jump into, I want to go into some of the applications, because I don't want to assume that everybody understands all the applications for cell therapy. They're exciting. This space is exploding, which is why you guys are at a great spot at a great time in history. Let's just touch on some of those. Let's touch a little bit on, you know, everything from long COVID to MS to Alzheimer's. And as you mentioned, orthopedic applications. I mean, there's so many different things that this technology can be applied to. Just give us a sense for the person at home who's not familiar with all of the cutting edge things that cell therapy is involved in right now.
Yeah. So I think where most people get it wrong is too much breadth and lack of focus. So where our focus really is in is Jim's research over the last 22 years and monetizing that. It seems like an easy process, but where our focus is in autoimmune and anti-inflammatory. That is where our cells work best. So that's great news. We know what we're doing. The bad news is the addressable market and what you can attach yourself to your cells and treat is very broad. So one of the things that I brought to the company is remaining focused on our first two INDs that have been in existence for 16 months now and execute those. And to your point, those are Pitt-Hopkins, which is a rare pediatric affliction, which is basically the combination of MS, IBS, autism, and cerebral palsy. It's a very small addressable market. However, we feel that that is our best foot forward to demonstrate the capability of the cells. From there, we moved on to what is, you know, a lot of people roll their eyes at, which is long COVID. Many people say, don't touch on long COVID because there's so much political uncertainty. Some people say long COVID doesn't exist. I'm not there to make that argument because the Department of Labor has already made that argument for us. They have stated that we're going to lose 6 million workers per year over the next 5 years in the workforce. The impact of the U.S. economy is about $6.8 billion per year. So I don't need to go out and demonstrate the need. What I need to focus on is the fact that our cells address autoimmune anti-inflammatory. And what science has basically demonstrated to us is long COVID is not a respiratory traditional flu, but rather dealing with the vascular system and an inflammatory response there. So as the group of scientists sitting here at Vitra, we say, we address inflammation very well with our cells. Long COVID is a great IND to go after affliction. The beauty to those two that I just mentioned is they're very short trials. They're very small addressable markets that we would go for in a trial and very short follow-up. You know, historically, when you go after an oncology or a cancer affliction, especially in the pediatric space, you're looking at 4 to 5 years through your trials, demonstrate your data to the FDA and work through that process. These two trials that we've gone after first are very short, small addressable markets. And then the third is a little bit broader within the MS community. So I mentioned the fact that our cells are currently used. One very important piece of data to share is that we have treated through emergency use authorization in the United States. And I mentioned our cells are used outside the United States. So we have a pool of 300 plus patients that have been treated. And we have had, you know, I always say knock on wood, but we've had zero SAEs, severe adverse effects, which is critical. And that is a huge point of data for the company. And that the FDA has concerns on, is your therapy safe and can it be used? And in our case, we've had zero SAEs. And I say knock on wood because you will get them at some point. Sure. But safety and efficacy is a massive point of where you always start with the FDA. So we have a lot of anecdotal data of our cells being used outside the United States, that we're not just sort of putting a finger up in the wind and guesstimating what's next after Pitt-Hopkins and long COVID. Yep. We've got very good data of our cells being used inside and outside the United States to say, where do you have high treatment efficacy. And so we're able to look at MS, Alzheimer's, and all of these areas that our cells can address. And where do we have solid core data to go after the next INDs?
Let's tie this into somebody who's listening to this says, this is really compelling. I get that this is, you know, cutting edge part of medicine. Where does this company head in terms of outcome for its shareholders? But in the near term, what are the types of investors that could get involved in this and take this ride with you?
Yeah, it's an interesting topic. We discuss it often, the board and I, et cetera, because if you look at traditional pharma, you typically go out and raise capital. You do it very, very early, and you have to pay for that time frame of clinical trial, which is demonstrating the safety and efficacy. You go through that process with the FDA. That's typically 2 to 3 years. We're beyond that by a couple of years. And so what's interesting is we fall into a place where we're not like a traditional biotech, if you will. And I don't even like to refer to the company as a biotech, because that gives the connotation that you put money into the company and you hope that one of those 3 to 4 therapies works, and maybe a big pharma comes in and purchases it, and you have a liquidity event in, say, 4 to 5 years. What's unique about our firm is I mentioned that we are generating revenue today through selling our cells and various components of our cell therapy to big pharma. So that's a component of revenue. In addition to that, when we manufacture Allerax, one of the byproducts as we go through that process I mentioned is a product that we manufacture of our exosomes. So our exosomes are currently being used. We do sell them in the cosmeceutical space. However, we keep the focus of the firm on Allerax and those INDs and doing that. So it puts us in a very unique space in that we're generating revenue. So the return on investment could be 12 months, 24 months, but it is definitely shorter than traditional biotech out there.
It's really interesting. As a business person coming into this role, and you mentioned some of the challenges, just there's complexity. There's a lot of opportunities, more opportunities than any startup, let alone a large organization, could address effectively. So as you went through and kind of delineated those different applications, how, you know, just walk us through your thinking a little bit and how you've helped to kind of go from broad down to a bit more narrow so that the company can execute.
Yeah, I think, look, we've seen it since, you know, the investing days of tech, telecom, media, medical devices, the late 90s. If you go back and look at, if you say it's a Harvard case study, or just diving into why did a company fail, there's really two major reasons. Number one is lack of focus. Number two is communication within the company. What are you trying to focus on? And you think about biotech and tech, what typically happens is something new gets created or invented, and that becomes the hot dot. It addresses, we saw it a couple of weeks ago with Microsoft and their AI announcement. You know, we're going to put Google out of business. That's exciting, but we're in the first inning. So it's the same here at Vitro, and that is really a maniacal focus on what is executable, what is the low-hanging fruit, execute on that business model, but keep an eye on the future to say, what is the pipeline? And we're working to filter that funnel down to say, great, we know what our steps are. We're starting our human trials in April. Those will go along. We know exactly what the rules of engagement and are for the FDA, but what is down for tomorrow, 24, 25? Keeping the focus on today with a mindful eye on the future, that we're developing a very robust pipeline. It is not simply we think something might work. We've actually got empirical data to back up that pipeline.
I love it, because as you've told the story and as I've thought about it, you've got this really interesting combination. While it's, you know, there's work and it's complex to navigate, the reality is there's a lot of proven data here. So it's not like a, you know, like you said, a biotech startup that may work someday and you have no idea it's going to be binary. You know, there's already some value there. There's safety there. And similarly, you're not, you know, kind of hoping that in 5 to 7 years, there's an outcome here after $100 million. You've got this nice sweet spot of, you know, credibility and data and probably not a long time horizon. Doesn't mean there's no risk left, and doesn't mean there's not a lot of hard work left, but it's a much more navigatable journey for you. So walk us through, you know, that journey for the next 6 to 12 months. You're going to raise a little bit of capital to get you to the next step, but talk a little bit about the capital needs and then those milestones in the near term.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the luxuries I had in coming to Vitro is that a lot of the blocking and tackling have been done by Jim and the team on the research side. So the preclinical investigation of, do our cells actually work out there? So the focus right now is with the capital needs, it is all going 100%, 98% towards the human trials. So effectively, we know what our research has led us to. We have very good empirical data to look at what we believe our success will be. Now it's pulling those levers and saying, let's start the human trials and get to these inflection points, which are critical to show that if your first 30 patients, here's what the data showed, and we can share that. Secondarily, then, as far as focus for the company, is being good stewards of capital. Again, I'm a student of the market. At core, I'm a finance person. So the biggest thing I've done is dove into where did traditional cell-based therapy companies or biotechs fail? There's really three areas. Number one is being poor stewards of capital. You look at companies, they've raised $50, $80 million, and they think that, well, that's it. We've got these coffers. We've got a money tree in the basement. Let's just go spend. We've been very disciplined. We've broken down the company to look at our COGS, make sure we know to the penny our manufacturing costs. Secondarily, we've looked at our manufacturing capabilities. Can we meet demand? Because obviously, if the trials are successful, can we produce the Allerex in our existing facilities? So we don't have massive expansion plans to say, let's go build a very sexy, shiny factory in order to manufacture the cells. We can do perfectly fine with our existing establishment in Golden. The second area, or let's go into the third, really, as far as errors that the biotechs have made, is they'll go out and raise capital and they get to these inflection points and they think that, you know, some magically something's going to happen. You have to have a plan beyond that through either licensing, commercialization, capabilities there, what those relationships are. And, you know, the old adage, if you didn't plant an oak tree 40 years ago, plant one today. So what I've been focused on is where the company's going 24, 25, 26. Do we have those relationships with existing big pharma, as well as the other items where we can generate revenue? I mentioned our exosomes and capabilities there. So keeping that in an outsourced model, and again, I think that's the third area that being good stewards of capital is beyond manufacturing capabilities and the shiny new car sitting in the garage, is going out and saying, do you need to develop this in-house? Where are there expertise and capabilities that you can outsource this to keep the company focused? And our answer to all three of those is we know our manufacturing, we know our CapEx, all of our dollars raised are going towards the human trials. We're not expanding and building a new production facility. And lastly, we're establishing those relationships that what happens in 24, 25, and 26, we've got those partnerships built that we can keep the company focused on the science. The capabilities for commercialization are being outsourced. So it's a very low demand on the P&L.
I love it. I mean, it sounds like, you know, maybe to be a little flippant, but a lot of biotech companies are essentially playing roulette. They're betting on red 12. You guys have the ability to control your own destiny here. It's a little more of a conservative approach, but you're not betting everything on, you know, you've got a sustainable business that's driving revenue. It doesn't need to explode. And as you said, you don't need to go spend a ton of capital on new factories or manufacturing facilities. So I love it. You've got the ability to control your destiny to a large extent. I want to just highlight the capital needs a little bit further, because again, a lot of people, they think biotech, they think, well, you're you know, probably going to raise 50 to 100 million. And that's not the case. You're really looking for a much more modest raise. Kind of walk through the terms or the raise that you're looking to and the types of investors you expect might fill that over the next couple of weeks and months.
Yeah. So I think, where the focus and typically what historically has happened is a biotech will go out and say, we're raising 15, that's it, we're done. And then they come back and raise 80 and people get diluted. My goal is really, I wake up every morning saying, how can I de-risk this transaction in theory for an investor and then for the board or existing investors and potential? The way that you do that is focusing in on existing revenues. Can you expand those revenues that the company is self-sufficient? We've addressed that and said yes and put a plan in place to take revenue and expand them. Secondarily, is we've got to launch these trials. So our capital raise is very small. We're seeking right now $4 million that allows me to go out and expand the opportunities there. So if you think about a range of outcomes, you always have to be looking at what's the best case, what's the best case, base case, and what's the worst case. So if I think about it with the risk hat on, the worst case scenario from existing revenues and a $4 million raise, it gives me the optionality to do one of two things. One, because we've managed expenses well, we can take that $4 million, start the first trial for Pitt-Hopkins, publish our data, expand that, generate the revenue to go on to trials 2 and 3. The second option is that we can take the $4 million and we can take on a very small nominal portion of debt to fully fund all three trials. The total capital needs for that are only $10 million. So when you're looking at debt, in my mind right now, debt is an easy way to finance the company, not dilute my current shareholders and potential future shareholders, and keep the focus on, again, going back to those launching of the two trials and the third trial coming up, potentially starting in Q3, and keep the focus there. So the goal in looking at this from that risk cap, keep and raise the least amount of money possible to keep it de-risked and execute the business plan. So we have a luxury again, it's a tailwind in that the capital needs right now are really only $4 million. That allows me to execute the company and move forward. If you look at most biotechs out there right now, about 87% of the companies out there do not have the funds to sustain themselves for 2 years. So that is a critical barrier of entry to me, is to be mindful of not just today and launching the trials, but making this a sustainable company. What that results in for the shareholders that are looking at the company is an ROI that's much shorter than traditional biotech. And the outcomes that we've got, if you look at the viability of the company a year ago, you've got 10% of a total vector that you can. What I've been focusing on is opening up to 180 degrees. And the best way that we know to do that is de-risk it, generate revenue, and keep the focus.
Do you have any preference for the types of investors that might fill that, you know, $4 million block? Are you looking for individuals, institutions, a mix? How do you think about that?
You know, they always say within companies is always be capital raising and any dollar's a good dollar. I would disagree with that. In that we want people to understand what the goals in mind are that we are doing here. One of the things I enjoy is Jim Music, who founded the firm. I love the fact that he gets a twinkle in his eye and says, we're helping people here. And so that to me is a very big impact in that our shareholders understand, number one, what we're doing, we communicate that to them. We keep consistency of focus. So if people can understand what the business plan looks like, the outcome expectations, understanding the risks, I don't have a bias toward whether it is an institution, a biotech fund, a high net worth individual, as long as they understand what the mission of the company is. And I've done my job to communicate what that mission is.
Love it. Chris, we're going to be excited to, you know, learn and stay close to the progress over the coming year. You guys have a lot coming down the pipe. It's going to be fun. So thanks for spending a little time on the show today and giving us a little overview of Vitro.
Thanks, Tobin. Appreciate it.
See you again soon for the next episode of Innovation for Alpha. Make sure to go to Innovation for Alpha for access to prior episode links, show notes, and other valuable resources. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any investment decisions, please consult with a professional. This show is copyrighted by Angel Indie Media, and written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.